So, happy Wednesday, September 14th, Lecture 5. Lecture notes page should be 50 when we get there. If you want to hobnob with some really smart people and perhaps meet the ambassador for whom the college is now named, you're welcome to join us to meet Mario Gabelli, Chairman and CEO of Gameco Investors, Inc., to speak on campus October 12th. You do need to register, although this is open to the public. If you're interested in entrepreneurship, finance, and economics in particular, you're encouraged to attend, and everyone is invited. I will, of course, have these in the housekeeping slides on Canvas, yeah, if you want to proceed with that. We've already seen this before, so if you want to network for a goal or donate t-shirts, there you go. Mini test 2, as you know, is open. I'm going to address more of that in just a minute. It opened, so I forgot to move my arrow. So today is lecture 5. We're September 14th. Mini test 2 is open. It closes on Saturday. So, as we talked about before, due to the lawsuit at CSU, where a federal judge said that room scans are not legal, we can't scan your room, it's an illegal search, so we decided that we would remove the room scan option from Proctorio. It's not there anymore on my side. Somebody said they saw it requested on your side, but I don't know about that. So for mini test 2, I wanted to put the lockdown browser. I know it doesn't stop all possible cheating, but it makes it harder to copy questions and put them on the internet. So I did that. Unfortunately, when I did it, I found out in fixing the problem, getting rid of the room scan for Kent State, as you see, they locked down the record student button. I can't turn it off. And they locked down the camera check button. I can't turn it off. And it's also asking for your ID or it's not. Okay. So those two buttons, I can't turn off. So I spent an hour and a half yesterday with the techs. And when I get to the tech, it's not like, did you turn on the machine? Did you reboot? I'm at a higher level than that. So we're at the high level here talking about it. And after 90 minutes, they said, yeah, it's not as it should be. So, and there's no way to fix it right now. So it's off with the vendor. They hope to hear from the vendor today. Who knows? Will it be fixed by Friday? Who knows? So at least for now, Mini Test 2 inadvertently is going to record you, meaning you have to have a camera to take the test. You wouldn't need one for the midterm and the final anyhow. Don't have one? Go to a computer lab. Go to the library. Borrow a friend's. You can't do any of those things, let me know. Maybe I can sit with you while you take your mini test, which seems a little silly. Questions on what's going on here? I'm not going to sit and review, although I do for the midterms and the final, I'm not going to sit and review your recorded tests because I didn't intend to record them to begin with. All right? No questions. We're good? Okay. So the first of the optional extra credits will open tomorrow and run for a week. So it's going to open Thursday morning, 8 a.m., if I remember to get it up. It'll run until next Wednesday, 11:59 p.m. You can earn extra credit one of two ways, right? If you stayed with Flashbooks, you can go to McGraw-Hill from our website. Actually, you'll go down to extra credit and click on the assignment. It'll take you over 3 attempts. Keep your high score. Each one counts for up to 0.3%. 10 of those adds 3% to your course grade. Or, if you like, because you didn't stay with Flashbooks, you can sign up for, in the extra credit module, PacPac. Ask one interesting question, answer two interesting questions, 0.1, 0.1, 0.1, 0.3 times 10, 3% for the course. Yeah? Yes, ma'am?
Just a quick question about the ELC.
Enhanced Learning Extra Credit on Connect, yeah?
Cover like previous lectures or current lectures?
Wherever it's usually probably going to be previous, okay. But it's wherever I get to when I set it up that day.
Okay.
Yeah, but mostly it's going over material we've covered, I think. That's the general thing. So it's a review of the material. And some students over the years who participated in it, believe it or not, actually find it interesting to do. Whether or not you will, I don't know. Questions on the extra credits, it's going to open tomorrow and run for a week. Optional, but when you get to the end of the course and we need that extra bump, it's worth it. Marketing in the news. How many folks are attuned enough to the NFL to know that Amazon signed an exclusive deal for Thursday Night Football? Do you guys know that? A couple do, okay. So Amazon's NFL advertisers include Mercedes, DraftKings, and Little Caesars. Did you know that last year Amazon signed an 11-season deal at an estimated $1 billion a year to run Thursday Night Football exclusively on Prime Video? It was the first time a streaming platform won exclusive NFL rights. The games still run on local broadcasts where the games are being played, but nationally, Amazon controls the program. So we're seeing a bit of sports marketing writ big at $1 billion a year in marketing. Last week, Amazon announced its first brand advertiser deal with Carnival Cruise Line. And this week, it announced Little Caesars, DraftKings, and Mercedes-Benz USA as sponsors. So we're seeing a bit about sponsorship and marketing. Carnival Cruise Line, for instance, has its name on a Wednesday night football show called the NFL Powwow, hosted by SNL alum Taron Killam, and will run commercials during the games throughout the season. Little Caesars, which is the official pizza of the NFL, is sponsoring the Thursday Night Football Tonight pregame show, which will feature an on-screen QR code that leads viewers to a pizza delivery. DraftKings, meanwhile, will be the sponsor of the gambling odds presented in a segment on the pregame show called TNF Predictions. So some benefits if you're a sponsor, you get to engage with that target audience in a variety of different ways, right? So, of course, which one of these is the one I want? I didn't hook up either of these. Rats. Let's try this one. I think this is their ad running to B2B. Hey, advertise on our show. Let's see if I got the right one.
Amazon Ads helps you reach your audience while they're cheering for their favorite teams during Thursday Night Football. Streaming exclusively on Prime Video and Twitch.
Exclusively.
Big Trav, snack me. Oh, mustard? Amazon Ads. Your brand, their world.
So you may have actually seen that on some, you know, over the network or streaming. I've seen that ad on television. It's not targeting me. It's targeting advertisers who might want to be on the Thursday Night Football channel. Carnival was particularly interested in the type of audience that Amazon could deliver, people 25 to 54 years old. The streaming demographic, we just talked about demographics as an external factor that we have to pay attention to, and we talked about segmentation, has dramatically grown to the older ages, says the Carnival's senior director of media strategy, and Carnival is hoping to change with the times. CTV, that's streaming over a connected TV, a smart TV, is a big part of our media mix, just by the nature of the way consumer consumption has changed. So we're seeing the company trying to reach their target audience and adapting to changes in their consumers' behavior. Remember what I said? You got to watch to see what's going on with the consumer and make sure that you understand how their norms of behavior are changing and adapt to that. NFL sponsors are often major brands looking for the widest reach, and some brands have held back on signing up until they see how successful Amazon is in courting the masses of football fans. Streaming live sports in general is still a little unproven, says a media buyer at a major brand. So media strategies vary. But if you want to watch know how to watch Thursday Night Football for free on Amazon Prime Video, there's a link to do that. All right? So, marketing the news in sports. How many of you guys know SodaStream? Do you guys know the brand? It had a little bit of a pop several years ago. Pop. Soda, pop, Pittsburgh, pop. And a little bit of a pop a while ago. And they've been out there, and now they're trying to refresh themselves. Behind SodaStream's design and product overhaul, SodaStream, once known as a spunky upstart with ads mocking the big soda companies, continues to pursue a more refined marketing approach nearly 4 years after PepsiCo bought its one-time competitors. So we're seeing a bit about their brand image. They're trying to refresh themselves and Pepsi's corporate growth strategy. How are we growing? By acquisition. The brand's latest moves include a design overhaul, new tagline, and more upscale product lineup that seeks to appeal to a design-obsessed and environmentally conscious consumer. Changing societal norms that we were just talking about, impacting our consumers, what's it mean for our marketing mix? The redesign includes a new logo featuring two interlocking water droplets. You can see the new logo up here. Arranged in a yin and yang formation, which SodaStream describes as depicting balance and harmony, as well as resembling the planet. So that's the brand image. The new look, which will be included on packaging soon, hitting the market, follows the debut of a new tagline, Push for Better, which began appearing in advertising earlier this year, replacing the Better for You, Better for the Planet tagline. So brand taglines, they are still a thing out there.
I don't get dehydrated.
water is what you make it. SodaStream, push for better.
So that's the short ad. The changes come as SodaStream begins selling a new premium product line of sparkling water makers called the SodaStream Collection. They include features such as Quick Connect, described in a press release as giving the consumer a more seamless experience by simply snap locking the bottle into place and inserting the carbonating cylinder with one click. I should have mentioned press releases, a form of promotion. You have a lot of people out there that have to write a lot of stuff every day. If you have anything new to sell, you want to send them a press release, a form of publicity, hoping they'll pick it up and give you free publicity on their blog, on their website. So, new product introduction, a product development growth strategy, where we have a new product, we're going to try to sell more of it to existing customers. One of the machine ads that I just showed you, art, oh, maybe not. One of the machine's branded art sells for about $130, aimed at design enthusiasts. I don't get it, but I assume other people do.
What can you make with water?
Not much.
You wonder. Water can be so much more than water. Water can wear any shape you wish. Water is alive, always moving. Water can have no flavor, more flavor, red flavor. Water can become a work of art in the right hands. Yours. SodaStream Art, the art of making fresh, sparkling water.
I messed up either target audience. That doesn't resonate with me. It's water. Flavored water, sure. But I guess you can do art with it. $130 for that, aimed at the art design enthusiasts, coming in colors such as misty blue and mandarin red, appealing to a target market, and price in the mix. Another model called Duo has not hit the U.S. market yet, but is being promoted in other countries as the first machine compatible for both glass and reusable plastic containers. SodaStream bottles, SodaStream is sold in 47 countries. So we're seeing a bit about how they're rolling out a product globally in different areas and a bit about global marketing. PepsiCo, which acquired SodaStream for $3.2 billion in 2018, has increasingly promoted SodaStream's mission as a response to rising consumer demand for brands and products that are perceived as sustainable. Another change in the social norms outside of our control that influence our consumers and us. So sustainability marketing. Finally, cultural fluency helps multicultural marketing succeed with all Americans. Multicultural representation is essential for any marketing strategy that hopes to connect with a broad spectrum of consumers, because this broad spectrum of consumers is multicultural. And with Hispanic Heritage Month beginning on September 15th, the purchasing power of Hispanic Americans may be top of the mind for many marketers. So we have to understand cultural market segments, ethnicity, which we either did talk about or will talk about. For the past 10 years, the United States demographic landscape has shifted dramatically. There are now approximately 140 million non-white Americans, representing more than 42% of the country's population. And Hispanic America is at the forefront of this transformation. The U.S. Hispanic population reached at least 62.1 million in 2020, accounting for 19% of all Americans, thus making it the nation's second largest racial or ethnic group behind white Americans. So here's a significant market. If your brand resonates with this group. Cultural fluency can create cultural relevance with specific multicultural segments and also resonate with appeal to Americans in general, at large. To be culturally fluent is to bring authentic cultural expressions forward as a core component of your brand's broad communications and marketing agenda. So how to appeal to that target market? But to resonate with Hispanic Americans, for example, marketing needs to go beyond the surface level strategies like just translating your ad into Spanish. You have to understand the values of that target audience. 60% of Hispanic respondents in a study are more likely to buy from a brand that supports their own race or ethnicity, but focusing just on a single group may not be adequate for your marketing mix. By focusing on commonly connectable themes like family or cultural traits that are high for a segment but shared by all, like warmth, a brand can resonate not just with the Hispanic audience, but with all Americans. And that's thanks to something called the halo effect, which occurs when an ad contains a story or a theme that culturally translates across diverse consumer groups. What that means is now you can be targeted and mainstream at the same time. If you get the ingredients right, you won't have to fear any backlash. An example of this is Subaru's Crosstrek Girls Trip commercial.
Thank you for taking me home. It's so far.
Don't worry about it, Grandma. This will be fun.
Two chocolate milkshakes, please.
Make it three.
Three?
Did you get his number?
No, Grandma. Grandma!
Excuse me.
Some relationships get better with time. That's why I got a Crosstrek.
97% of Subaru vehicles sold in the last 10 years are still on the road.
I'm so glad you got a Subaru.
I wonder who gave me the idea.
Oh. Love. It's what makes Subaru, Subaru.
Okay, appeals to the Hispanic community, but also to others as well. It shows a deep multi-generational bonding, grandmother and granddaughter, not only a critical part of the Hispanic experience, but also emblematic of the universality of certain themes. The scene connects with the human experience, no matter how specific the representation is of that Hispanic grandmother-granddaughter relationship. So, might work for your brand to have a multicultural approach. Okay, pick up with lecture notes page 50 and page 78 in the textbook. And we were talking about these social groups, and we ended with the post-war cohort. And I asked you, and I meant to bring in a brochure. We keep getting mailers, catalogs from the Vermont Country Store. And I think no one raised their hand. Nobody knows the Vermont Country Store. Was that right? Webby's? Anybody, you guys know it? A couple of you? So the Vermont Country Store is a highly successful marketer of nostalgic products that are difficult to find. And they use cohort images, especially with this post-war cohort group, and memories to target various market segments. To capture the attention of the post-war cohort customers, it carries many older brands, and in fact, given the research they have on these people, even brings old brands back to life and sells it for these groups.
A New England store is like a time machine. CBS This Morning contributor Lee Woodruff shows us how one store's loyal customers continue to indulge in the pleasures of a simpler and slower America. Its famous mail order catalog attracts customers from all around the world.
Weston, Vermont, population 600, is the unlikely home of one of the state's top tourist attractions.
135.
A third generation family owned country store that's in the business of selling nostalgia.
Bye.
Bye.
What's your definition of a country store?
A country store was a place that you would go into in these small communities. 150 years ago, you didn't have the internet, and you would go to the country store to get just about anything that you needed.
In 1946, the Ortons started the Vermont Country Store catalog, and when the orders began rolling in, the Ortons opened a storefront. Almost 70 years later, the desire for hard-to-find, old-fashioned products is now a mega-million-dollar business. Customers of the Vermont Country Store keep coming back for their old favorites, and occasionally, their demand for a product has actually brought it back from extinction.
I think big sellers are usually ones that customers connect with. Products like our Tangi lipstick.
Another product that went extinct.
Extinct. It was no longer available. We started to work with a company to manufacture it.
The store and the catalog appeal to the young and the old. Another part of the country store's success? Tour buses.
I think history is a huge part of why people come to Vermont, and we have busloads of customers that come from England, and Vermont is really, feels to them like old America.
Oh, it's cute.
The store proudly resists any urge to update its clothing to fit current trends.
And this is one of your best sellers.
One of the best. Yeah. It's enduring. It's a timeless product.
Nothing says chaste and pure like a lounge nightgown, right? Like
house-made creams, lotions, and tonics fill the shelves of the store's remedy section.
There's some really cool, bizarre, old-fashioned remedies for things
that
you don't think about so much anymore. Bunion corrector, right?
Yes.
So in this era of Amazon and the internet where you can touch a button and get everything, what do you think it is about the Vermont Country Store that just keeps people coming back?
I feel a time-honored tradition that's there. almost a smell and a feeling that it's been here forever, and that no matter what you need, you can find it here.
A tradition that the Orton brothers aren't about to change. For CBS This Morning, Lee Woodruff, Weston, Vermont.
So we have a cohort group that grew up with a particular set of values, a particular set of products, and maybe aren't that savvy or interested in learning all about the internet, but here's a store that resonates with them, and they aren't changing to be snazzy and jazzy. They're appealing to that segment quite successfully with their store. So there's an entity, a business that understands the idea of a cohort, understanding their values, and having an entire product line that appeals to them and draws them internationally on tours. The leading edge baby boomer cohort, born 46 to 55, age 67 to 76 in 2022. This group, as their memory, they remember the assassinations of John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. It was the loss of JFK that first shaped this cohort's values and were catalyzed by the opposition to the Vietnam War. Anybody here of May 4th? Leading edge baby boomers are very aware of their cohort grouping. They are very self-assured. They're very self-centered as a group, given their background. They champion causes with fervor because they were sure of being right. So you guys know Greenpeace as an entity, the not-for-profit organization, Greenpeace. Civil rights, women's lib, they were equally justified in being hedonistic. If the van is rocking, don't come knocking. And self-indulgent, pot, free love, sensuality were all in this cohort's coming-of-age years. Because of their position following the birth-dearth of the Depression years, they had and continue to have an influence on society disproportionate to their numbers. If there's one thing that boomers hate, it's being considered old. Now, mind you, they are what I say. They are 67 to 76. They ain't spring chickens, but don't talk about them being old. In a society that largely ignores or coddles seniors, they have an intense desire to remain young, relevant, and useful. Any reference to their age or limitations will be an instant turnoff. Appeal to them with language that alludes to the advantage of being established and the opportunities of retirement and beyond, and the authority that comes with seniority.
People think you can't do things after a certain age or at a certain age. Prove them wrong by just doing it. I ran an ultramarathon when I was 51.
We run an online business together.
It doesn't matter your age, it matters how much energy you put into something.
I'm 28 years old and I'm running for office.
I got a tattoo at the age of 51.
It makes me feel like a rock star. It's about how you feel and your outlook on life. It doesn't matter how old you are.
So AARP appeals to you if you're 50 and older, but also older. We're not going to talk about you being old. We're talking about the experience you have and things you can do. So a company that really succeeds at digitally marketing to baby boomers is AARP. Its AARP Possibilities page uses legible fonts, attractive celebrities, and positive, buoyant language about life after 60. Consider this a model for attracting and keeping that advanced age audience. Sure. So there's a video from them. Trailing edge baby boomer cohort, born 56 to 64, age 58 to 66 in this year. This group witnessed the fall of Vietnam, Watergate, Nixon's resignation, the oil embargo, raising inflation rates. Wait a minute, that's beginning to sound familiar. And the more than 30% decline in the S&P index led these individuals to be far less optimistic about their financial future than leading edge baby boomers, whom they feel got bigger opportunities in jobs, houses, and investments. And those feelings stay with them today. They're embedded in who these people are. Baby boomer grandparents are healthy, active, educated, and endowed with sizable nest eggs. Spending by grandparents on their grandchildren is on the rise. Grandkids Matter is a site dedicated to validate and empower grandparents as they bond with the future generations in meaningful ways and leave a lasting positive legacy. So here's a business that actually is going to help grandparents think about their grandchildren, the sorts of things that they might want to do, and, of course, the sorts of products they might want to have if you're going to buy something for them. Generation X, 65 to 80, age 42 to 57. These are the latchkey children of the 80s. They received the most negative publicity of any of the cohort groups, perhaps because many have seen firsthand the trauma of divorce. This cohort has delayed marriage and children, and they don't take those commitments lightly. Gen Xers have been labeled as baby busters, because they're putting off having kids, latchkey kids, and slackers. Anybody watch the Back to the Future movies and the original one in the classroom? And he's always picking on Marty and his group, and he's like, slacker, you're a slacker, referring to this age group in this time period. Also the Why Me generation and the New Lost generation, my goodness. Despite a rocky start into adulthood, this group shows a spirit of entrepreneurship unmatched by any other cohort. And of course, this is why we are, in part, why we are the College of Business and Entrepreneurship, and we have programs in entrepreneurship. Playing up to, wrong word. Taking into account this entrepreneurship desire. Take a look at many internet startups and you find successful Gen Xers who, quote, did it their way. More than any other group, this cohort accepts cultural diversity and puts quality of personal life ahead of work, which was making business people crazy. We're used as managers of businesses to saying to you, congratulations, you got a promotion, you're going to move to Iowa. And you would move. Gen Xers are saying, thanks. I got my social network here. I got my friends here. Forget the promotion. I'll just stay here. What? How do you manage HR people? Anybody in HR? How do you manage that sort? How are you going to manage that sort of person? A change in the way we have to deal with our employees based on the cohort. Reaching Gen Xers is complicated. Many Xers rely on traditional media, with 62% reading newspapers, 48% listening to the radio, and 85% having favorite television shows. For Gen X, however, email is considered the gold standard for personal communications as well as business communications. Digital video is also huge among Gen Xers. It's even more popular than social networking. Over 75% download or stream video online at least once a month. Your digital marketing strategy then has to be on point to reach these skeptical Gen Xers. As kids, they were often children of divorce who came home to empty houses. These experiences have made them into independent, resourceful, and family-oriented adults. Well, we're thinking about if you're going to appeal to Gen Xers with your ads. Gen Y, born 81 to 96. They're 26 to 41 these days. Also known as, Millennial Generation or Gen Y. Their core value structure seems to be quite different from the previous generation. In 2015, the millennial generation surpassed the baby boomer generation as the nation's largest generation. Why does that matter? Because you have masses of people with particular values, particular needs, wants, and desires. As they age, they take things with them, and they're influencing your marketing mix, and all of a sudden, wait a minute, here's this group, but here's a bigger group coming at us with other needs, wants, and desires that we have to pay attention to. So as of 2015, that biggest group is millennial. Baby boomers are still big, but not the biggest. They're more digitally connected than any other generation before them because they grew up with it more. They're more idealistic and team-oriented without the cynical, what's in it for me, free agent mindset of many Xers. From whatever year this research was done on Gen Y, 91% prefer shopping in drugstores, 68% prefer shopping in consumer electronics stores, yay Best Buy, 80% prefer shopping in apparel stores, 84% prefer shopping in department stores, Saks is happy to hear that, and 83% prefer shopping in discount or mass merchandise stores, yay Kohl's. So, a bit about their mindset. As of 2020, millennial spending in the U.S. was at $2.5 trillion. How would you like a piece of that in your business? Yeah? Representing about 30% of total retail sales. They trust word of mouth buzz more than they trust customary print ads, television ads, newspaper ads. They like hearing what other people have to say. When you go online to check out a new brand or check out a new place to visit, do you click and see what the reviews are to see what the buzz is, what people are saying? Yeah. So make reviews a large feature of your service or product page to leverage the millennials' need to conduct independent research, to find testimonials from unbiased sources. We do a fair bit of traveling in the off time, and my wife is always looking at new places to go to. And man, if she clicks on a site to visit and there are no reviews for this place, boom, we're gone. We aren't looking at it anymore. There's something wrong with them. Encourage your customers to submit user-generated content through contests or discounts, an interesting strategy. If you really like it, there's additional information there. These folks value experiences over possessions. You can't take it with you. Let's live for it now. Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines presented passengers with virtual balconies, a video of a real-time stream of what was going on.
Hyundai Tucson versus Honda CRV. Look what Tucson has and what CRV.
Virtual balcony staterooms, as the name implies, these interior rooms offer the unique feature of a high-definition screen that simulates an ocean-facing balcony complete with ever-changing views.
So you can have the less expensive cabin inside and still have the experience of a balcony view. Millennials are at the forefront of the experience economy. How many of you guys have done escape rooms? How many of you guys have done axe throwing or stuff like that? The experience is the thing. Of course, you guys get to enjoy it too, but it's on the interests of the Gen X millennial group. So this will be Don Kosek talking about some experiences he's had and how businesses don't always follow what's going on with the consumers, how their trends might be changing, what their interests are.
So what we've done, we've taken residential, moved it over to the enterprise side. You know, again, my history, AT&T, 5 years ago, we didn't even know the cable companies existed, okay? In fact, AT&T tried to get into, it was Ameritech, SBC. We're in the cable business slightly. It was decided not a core competency. We moved out, okay? Guess what? They're trying to get back in because cable companies now are taking residential telephone lines. And as the new generation, you know, they don't even go with landlines.
The new generation doesn't even go, they're supposed to say land lines. And so we have to keep track of that. AT&T didn't pay attention to the cable business. Whoops, they missed an opportunity there. Obviously, they've gotten back in it since then. But you got to pay attention to these changes. Gen Z, let's see. We know anybody born between 97 and 2012? We know anybody? Okay. Let's see if you resonate with what I'm going to tell you about you. Age 10 to 25 in 2022, the new silent generation or homelander generation are the people that are reaching adulthood in the 2010s and who enter the workforce in the 2015s to 2025. This group of people are generally thought to be realistic. They became very familiar with computers and cell phones and iPods and video games at a much earlier age than generations late Y and all of X, thus leading to most of Gen Z preferring a more connected and LCD screen lifestyle, which I think you would agree to, which I think you know. Usually raised by leading edge baby boomer or Gen X, and sometimes have brothers or sisters of Gen Y and Z, their parents are the soccer moms, the helicopter parents. Gen Z calls their own shots. They refuse to be dictated to, whether it be by a clothing brand, a television network, or a website. In essence, they're creating their own experiences from fashion to entertainment, to communication. Whatever happened in the good old days, three networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, and we all watched the same thing on Wednesday night? Of course, it's long gone, but it's even more gone with the Gen Z, who wants to stream their own things at their own time, in their own pace, in their own way. They understand how scary the world could be. Having grown up post 9/11, we missed the memorial here in class, in the wake of the Great Recession, and amid countless reports of school violence, which unfortunately continues to go on, they seem the effects of the economy firsthand and are more aware of troubling times. Their role models are young, everyday characters like the Hunger Games' Katniss Everdeen. Whenever I ask, I don't get a lot of hands raised, but I like Katniss a lot. Anybody like Katniss? More hands than usual. Who face seemingly inescapable scenarios, but rise above them to create a better society. In these stories, relatable characters are empowered to defeat their circumstances, just like the Gen Zs, who feel a responsibility to change the status quo. Know this about them if you're advertising to them. Target actually created a brand, a new brand for GMC. So major brands well aware of this and doing what they can within their arenas to appeal to Gen Z. This is just a, you know, take it for what it's worth, sort of comparison between some of the stuff between millennials and Gen Z, nicknames for millennials, the me generation for Gen Z, the iGen, millennials on steroids, Roy models for millennials, Lena Dunham, Kanye, Michael Phelps for Gen Z, Katniss Everdeen, PewDiePie? I was curious to see the reaction. Stereotypes they're sick of hearing for millennials. They're entitled and need constant feedback and coddling. Gen Z, that they learn to swipe a screen before they learn to speak, etc. Never heard of, so again, this is a little facetiousness, but how many of you have seen a floppy disk? How many have never seen a floppy disk? Okay, that was, of course, I grew up with floppy disks, and of course, before that, the big 5 1/4 disks. So, or you guys have, quote, never seen flip phones. So, this is, as I say, a bit of silliness comparison. Millennials and Gen Z face the same crisis with different outlooks because they have different backgrounds, they have different values, they're different cohort groups. Both have been impacted by a series of once-in-a-lifetime crises in their formative years. The dot-com meltdown, 9/11, the Great Recession, and of course, the coronavirus global pandemic. But their reactions differ. Millennials were more concerned about the pandemic. 84% of many millennials said they were somewhat or very concerned about the COVID-19 pandemic. Only 78% of Gen Z said that. Millennials will be slower to return to the mall. 73% of millennial consumers say it may take them a while before they feel comfortable shopping again in a mall, while 62% of Gen Zers say, sure, we'll go back. The point, it's important to understand differences in the generational cohort responses to your potential marketing mix. What they mean for your brand is what we're getting at here. The newest generation, born 2013 through 2025. We must have a newer generation behind those then. So they ran out of letters, X, Y, Z. They rotated back to the beginning of the alphabet. We now have Generation Alpha. They promise to be the most highly educated, diverse, technology proficient generation so far. They may never have a landline phone or a checkbook. Electronic tablets are replacing teddy bears in their cribs at night, and they'll likely text their playmates instead of passing notes. They're expected to be socially and ecologically conscious, thanks to their millennial parents, who aren't just willing to settle for rock-bottom prices despite their frugal ways. Research shows millennials are willing to pay a premium for products made by companies that they see as being authentic in espousing their values, including sustainability, and they're going to pass that on to the Gen Alpha cohort, presumably. For now, Generation Alphas, of course, are still relative babies and toddlers, which means their parents will be making most of their buying decisions for at least the next decade. Their moms will be the parent calling the spending shots in most families. Today, women currently make or influence as much as 85% of purchasing decisions. Whoa. And by over 50% of traditionally male products, such as cars, home improvement products, and consumer electronics. You got to know that if you're in those fields for marketing. So not surprisingly, millennial moms control the majority of the buying decisions in the family. So be aware of that if you're appealing to the family overall. To reach Generation Alpha parents, be authentic, personalize your products, embrace and promote social responsibility. They care. Don't ignore the kids, if we're going for the family, though they're still young, research shows that children wield a great deal of influence in the grocery store aisles. When you go in the grocery store aisles, where do you find, what do you find at the checkout counter right about eye level-ish? Lots of?
Candy.
Why? Well, the kid's in the cart, you're pushing the cart along, you're having to stand there in front of the checkout, unless you go to self-checkout, and there's all the candy for the kid to covet. We could debate if that's really an ethical way to market candy, but kids like it. when accompanying their parents on shopping trips, these kids make demands that influence about 80% of the shopping decisions. What cereal do you want? What milk product do you want? All right, another social force is marital status. You can envision the fact that different folks in different marital statuses have different needs, wants, and desires, right? So, never married, single, have particular things that they want, married, separated, divorced, widowed. What is your likely target audience and what are their particular needs, wants, and desires? Cohabitation. Cohabitation has become increasingly accepted by a broad swath of social and demographic groups. Somebody help me with that term. What am I saying when I say cohabitation? Who knows what I'm talking about? Y'all let me use the word, move ahead, and didn't even stop me to say, what are you talking about? Did you ask? You didn't ask? What's cohabitation? Living together, in this case, the implication is with someone of, in a personal relationship. I can't say someone of the opposite gender because these days we can have personal relationships with the same gender without the benefit of marriage. Why do I care as a marketer if you're married living together or cohabitating relationship? Why would I care? Do you imagine? As a marketer. Do you think those people would have any differences in how they live their lives at all? Or no, they're identical. Say again? They would be different. They're going to have difference in terms of known longevity. They're going to have difference in terms of how they share finances. Do they buy the house together or not? Do they have different bank accounts or not? So we would want to know if that's a social norm that's different than what we were used to. Yeah, cohabitation. Blended families. What are the characteristics of your target market in terms of their marital status? And what's it mean for their needs, wants, and desires for your product? How are these things changing over time? Anybody ever watch Happy Days, or is that too old for you? Happy Days is a TV show? You watched it? Well, there you go. The only one. You're a little more experienced. So this was a time period when families lived together. There was not a lot of divorce. It was actually unheard of. And then we move into things like, what was the family that blended, the TV show that blended two families together?
Step by Step.
One of them, there's another one I'm trying to think of. It doesn't matter. Then we moved away from everybody being happy and living together forever to these families that are mixed and blended. Now you're joining different families with different needs, wants, and desires, different backgrounds and whatever, and we're trying to fit them together and market to them. What's your target audience? Racial and ethnic diversity. I think we've heard about that. The U.S. is a diverse and ever-evolving marketplace that caters to consumers from a variety of social, economic, and cultural backgrounds. Check back on our business in the news today about multicultural marketing. As the U.S. becomes more diverse through its people, tastes, customs, and beliefs, companies strive to target demographics using marketing styles that are sensitive to individual attitudes and practices. The importance of diversity in marketing has grown in response to the increasing diversity of the U.S. population. According to the U.S. Census, more than 50% of the American population is expected to be composed of minority groups by the year 2042. I don't know if I do this here or later on. I understand full well that individually, you personally may like or not like these facts. You may not like the fact that white America is going to be minority. You may think it's ducky. Your individual attitude doesn't matter so much if you're in a business. What is your business's attitude about this? And so we can certainly have businesses with different missions that have different views about how diverse they want to be. Who likes Chick-fil-A? What's the interesting thing about Chick-fil-A relative to what I'm talking about? Anybody know what I'm referring to?
They're really homophobic.
They are not in favor of a lot of gay rights. homophobic. And what else is special about them? What is it? And why are they closed on Sunday? They would say two reasons: God's work, religion, and because it's good for our employees. It improves productivity, right? That's fine for that company, for their values, for their market segment, okay? They have a particular stance, and they're entitled to do that. So, just because what I'm saying here is true, your company may decide to or not to embrace the need for multiculturalism, diversity, to be sensitive to these racial and ethnic diversity. And I forget if I bring this up later. And actually, the reason I'm harping on it right now was I had a student a semester or two ago who took me for task for being too liberal and not talking about the other side of the coin. There are companies and people that don't buy into this. So I thought, that's true. Perhaps I should bring that up. And I think it's going to pop up again. So what are we talking about here? Well, again, refer to my marketing the news slide today. Hispanic or Latino, 6.1 million in 2020, 18.7% of the total population. I have no idea if that actually agrees with my slide from earlier. They're the largest minority group in the U.S. They have over $2 trillion of disposable income, but at only 6% of the overall ad industry investment, Hispanic consumers make up a disproportionately small proportion of overall ad spending. So you're 18% of the population, but only 6% of advertising is focused on you. Hispanic identity is much more diverse than the media portrays. We have a quarter of U.S. Hispanics who identify as Afro-Latino, maybe not what comes to your mind when you think Hispanic. Over 70% prefer speaking Spanish at home. Yet, many brands rely on the fact that many of their Spanish-speaking consumers are bilingual, and rather than offering services in Spanish, they rely on English only. Of course, this keeps their costs down. They don't have to do everything in two languages, but it's not the best for those users, and you may lose consumers to marketers who are sensitive to your needs. Hispanic Americans are especially aware of social issues. They feel strongly they should be able to trust the brands that they purchase from. They feel they can influence change more strongly with their wallets than with their votes, than do other demographics. 54% felt they can better influence social issues through the brands that they buy rather than who they vote for. So if that's important to you, you'd want to know what are their values and how can you reflect them. So brands that align themselves with the values and issues that affect Hispanic communities are likely to find success. The big takeaway: brands have an opportunity with Hispanic consumers, and a big one. A more detailed understanding of this critical demographic is key to better serving them and reaping their benefits. We must understand our target audiences, our consumers. And up there, I think, are the states that have the largest Hispanic populations. African American as a racial ethnic group. In 2020, the Black American or African American population, 41.1 million, accounts for 12.4% of all people in the US, or in combination with another race, the population total 46.9 million people, 14.2% of the total population. Depends how you count your racial background. Blacks, African Americans, are the second largest minority population in the US and have a $1.6 trillion buying power. African Americans are not a homogeneous group. They're diverse from their skin tones, to their language, to their culture rules, to their mores, to the folkways. There are subcultures within the African American community. So, I'm going to have a makeup and I'm going to appeal to black women, and so I'll have all dark colors. Well, no. Look at African American women. They have all sorts of skin tones. Black consumers are much more likely to seek out and place emphasis on brands that are trustworthy, have a clear social mission, appeal to their cultural values, and generally have credibility in the black community. Black consumers are more heavily weighted in the trendsetter segment, which includes around 30% of black consumers. These are the folks who discover new products and services and proactively share them with their peers. If you can win these black consumers as customers, they're going to help you expand the recognition of your brand through their network and beyond. So we miss opportunities all the time with different segments. Here's missing opportunities with African Americans who, quote, drink bourbon. Yes, African Americans drink bourbon. You'd never know it from marketing. Groups like the Black Bourbon Society have formed to share an appreciation of the whiskey, and distillers are finally starting to pay attention. The growth is all coming from multicultural segments, says Ryan Robertson, head of the multicultural marketing for Diageo, the British spirits company that produces bourbon brands like Bulleit and I.W. Harper. For our brand to be sustained in the future, We absolutely have to start with a multicultural lens. For many black bourbon drinkers, the change isn't coming fast enough. They say that most of the brands, when they do reach out, still pigeonhole African-American consumers with outdated playbooks aimed at the, quote, urban demographic. Industry speak for lower income, younger black consumers who supposedly gravitate towards sweeter spirits like cognac and flavored whiskey. Don't promote to me with honey flavor or some hip-hop star, says Jamar Mack, 36, an African-American bourbon fan in Louisiana. My race is not my palate. Be aware of the subtleties of the differences in the groups you're looking at before you go to market to them, yeah? The Black Lives Matter movement reflects the intersection of systematic inequalities and the impact of COVID-19 in terms of health and economic impacts. The protests involving millions of people across the U.S. and outside of it, affecting global business and emphasizing the need for corporate social responsibility actions and social responsibility marketing, came to the front. The world's best-known brands have used their marketing channels to offer support. To be silent is to be complicit. Black Lives Matter, said Netflix on Twitter. We have a platform and we have a duty to our black members, employees, creators, and talent to speak up. Similar tweets have come out from Disney-owned Fox and Hulu. Apple Music joined the Blackout Tuesday campaign to raise awareness about issues of systematic ethnic inequality. Nike repurposed its famous for do it slogan for once don't do it. I don't know if that's still active or not. Once Don't Do It Nike, 1,000,004 views, 26,000 or more likes on YouTube for this campaign. Consumers are apparently holding brands more accountable for their actions, which in turn is causing brands which tend to deviate from politicization to break their silence. But how much of it is genuine and how much of it is just saving face? So brands are responding to consumers, but how much of it is lip service? Several brands have been opening up their purses and shelling out thousands for legal defense and bailout funds. Beauty company Glossier, for example, is donating $500,000 to six organizations and $500,000 in form of grants to black-owned beauty businesses. Many of the brands that have made significant monetary donations or have offered solutions through purposeful social initiatives are taking steps to correct their problematic pasts, a bit of social responsibility in their efforts. Target may be providing support for its 200 displaced Minneapolis employees and is promising to invest more in the city's black and brown communities, but that doesn't erase its history of racism at its home base. Uber spent up to $500 million on an apology campaign in 2018 to scrub its tarnished reputation. Grievances against the carpool company included allegations of racial discrimination by the company's former head of HR. So dealing with these issues can be difficult for marketers to figure out. Though imperfect, at least these brands are putting money where their mouths are instead of merely performing authenticity. Here are the brands offering up more than just words to support Black Lives Matter. Brands are giving back. Asian Americans, approximately 19.9 million people, 6% of the population. Asian Americans have about 1.3 trillion in spending power. As individuals with ethnic origins stemming from countries including Cambodia, China, India, Japan, Korea, Malaysia, Pakistan, the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam, these folks are overrepresented in high-earning sciences, technology, engineering, and mathematics-related fields. 23% of this group are involved in these fields versus 12% of the total population. These guys have money to spend. They may not be the biggest group, but they got some bucks. Might they be interesting to you? Should you know more about them? Family dynamics greatly influence buying decisions among Asian Americans. Asian American households are 70% larger than the average U.S. household and are more likely to be multi-generational, you know, grandma, son or daughter, grandchildren. The Asian American community includes speakers of thousands of diverse dialects and over 50 languages. 81% say they speak English fluently. Asian Americans set the pace for consumer tech consumption and are the most digitally connected consumer group. 97% own a smartphone. 99% have internet access. 89% own a computer. If you're a techie company, maybe you should know something about Asian Americans as a target audience. What we don't think of a lot of, but they're out there, American Indians and Alaska Natives. There are 5.7 million people who are American Indian and Alaska Native, either alone or in combination with one of the other ethnicities, making up a mere 1.7% of the total U.S. population. Native American buying power is about $145 billion, so not huge. The 10 states with the largest Native American markets are California, Oklahoma, Texas, Arizona, New York, New Mexico, Washington, Florida, North Carolina, and Alaska. And we don't often think of them as a huge target market, but in fact, Nike thought enough about them to develop a particular product for them. The Nike Swoosh Flies Again. N7 program is giving native golfers a lift. Anybody know anything about the American industry, American Indian, American, Native American Indian population culture? I'm not saying that very well. Anybody know what N7 might refer to? For any reason, maybe a little course you took? So the culture says that we should pay attention to the three generations that come before us, our current generation, and care for the land and care for three generations into the future. N7 is what that is sort of about culturally and where they pick up this idea. The winged Nike is once again swooshing over Indian country in the form of the new Nike N7 shoes, the latest version of the shoe designed specifically for American Indians as a way of promoting physical fitness. Why would you need to design a shoe specially for American Indians? Originally, this is actually the second version of what they've done. The original Air Native N7 was designed in 2007 with a larger fit for indigenous feet. It turned out that given the average Native foot, it's wider, broader than is the average white foot. And so they weren't comfortable in the existing shoes, as well as a culturally specific look. This is the first time Nike has designed a shoe for a specific race or ethnicity. This one's wider at the toe, has a thicker sock liner for comfort, fewer seams to cut down on irritation. The Nike N7 golf shoe is aimed at those natives who tee it up and aim for the green. So Nike paid attention to this particular group. White population, you may have heard of those. Overall, 235.4 million people reported as white alone or in combination with another group. The largest population group in the U.S., about 71%, while white only represents about 60%. This group's buying power is about $13.2 trillion. I would like a piece of that. Thank you. All right, so I guess I don't say too much more about the white population. Maybe you've heard of them before. So, which of these racial and ethnic groups might work for you? What about cultural trends? Well, there's been a change over time, maybe starting with those hippie dippies with Greenpeace and all that stuff, towards sustainability, being good for the planet, not ruining the environment for everybody. That's a trend that could influence healthy living. Another sort of thing, people want to eat better. The hashtag MeToo movement, LGBT rights. Do-it-yourselfers and makers is a bunch of ads that you'll see periodically from either Home Depot or Lowe's. Let's do it together for the do-it-yourselfers. We're going to build this thing together. Adventurers, cocooning, staying at home with more creature comforts, home networks, home theaters, staying at home and texting. Mind you that these trends aren't all the same for everybody. So on the one hand, we do have people out there doing, anybody an ex-sport, extreme sport person? Sometimes you get people doing X Games. Only one? Sometimes you get a couple. So we have folks that are out there doing kayaking and parachuting and beyond. At the same time, there's another trend for people cocooning. I just want to stay home and watch my home theater. Leave me alone. We have to be aware of these different trends. Patriotism. anti-racism. So this is where I guess I was getting to my point. Note that not all consumers support these, quote, liberal social trends. State Farm Insurance provided support for a program providing LGBTQ-themed children's books to teachers and libraries. Conservative groups and some media outlets derided the insurance company as a creepy neighbor and accused it of targeting children with books about gender identity. Hours after a report about the partnership prompted an online uproar from conservatives, State Farm announced that it was dropping its support of the Gender Cool Project, aimed at helping raise awareness around what it means to be transgender, inclusive, and non-binary. It's fine to have missions and goals, but you're still a business, and you have to stay in business. And with whatever activity you happen to take doesn't resonate with your target audience, then you've made a mistake somewhere. You might have to rethink whatever that strategy is. Not everybody's on board with the same thing. We're a diverse population. Nike faced a fierce backlash for its 2018 ad featuring Colin Kaepernick, the former NFL quarterback, who knelt during the national anthem to protest racism and police brutality. Marketers need to pay attention to their consumers' needs, wants, desires, and values and figure out how they're going to work with these issues. Nike's still out there, as is State Farm, but you have to be aware and sensitive to the other views that are out there. And this is another one of the sort of, is this a trend, guys? What do you think? How about a $180 linen skirt? Small target audience, we've got one guy to focus on. Everybody else, how many guys? Not for me. Guys? Well, it seems like it's one of two things. All right. So might have appeal for a small segment out there. That might be your audience. The other guys are going to go, leave me alone. Not for me. I'm not wearing a skirt. Right? Nothing wrong with my sundress. It's very airy. It's very comfortable. So what are the social trends and how might they influence you? The economy in general, of course, is a huge impact outside of us. We can't control it, but it certainly influences our consumers and us. These are factors relating to income, expenditures, resources that affect the cost of running a business and a household. And right now, as you know, we happen to be in an interesting period affecting these things with the inflation that's going on and the rising costs that are out there. Macroeconomic conditions, if you remember your macroeconomics course, consumer income levels. On the one hand, consumer income has been going up, right? The rise in consumer salaries, pays, whatever it is like up 5% or something. The problem is that inflation's up 8 or 9 or 10, whatever it is, percent. What's it mean for your business? So what's the gross income, the amount that people earn each year? What's their disposable income after taxes? What's the discretionary income after necessities? And that, of course, is going down. Your discretionary income after you buy groceries and gasoline and other necessities is shrinking. What's that mean for your business if you're selling to folks that a discretionary product? So bringing together a bit about social factors, economic factors, we have something called the ESRI community data. It says, identify the top three neighborhood lifestyles to better serve your customers. ESRI's Community Tapestry Segmentation System classifies each U.S. zip code based on socioeconomic and demographic characteristics to create 65 distinct market segments, 14 life mode groups, and 6 urbanization groups. Thinking about the neighborhood you grew up in. Neighborhood you grew up in? You grew up in. People grew up in all kinds of neighborhoods. But can you envision that many folks, not everyone in your neighborhood, had similar backgrounds, similar education levels, similar values? To be real broad about it, can we picture that the needs, wants, desires, values, income levels of folks in Beechwood, Hudson, Stowe, Ravenna are different from one another in mass? Okay, you can find exceptions, but they're different. Wouldn't it be nice for you to be able to identify those neighborhoods that reflect the income level, the values that you would like to focus on as we bring together social values and income levels? And that's what this company does for us. ESRI data. And they used to have. Okay, this is what I was trying to see if they still had. Can you give me a, somebody give me any zip code that you know. For what?
44240.
I was looking for something a little more diverse. So what is 442? Oh, according to these tapestry segmentation, 21% quote college towers as a group, 11% Emerald City, and 10% bright young professionals. And here's details about folks that live in this particular zip code. Somebody give me a totally different zip code from some, oops, it's not gonna let me do that. Come on, give me a break. Hold on, let me see if I can catch somebody else. All right, can we get one more just for fun? 98113. Did I get that right? Let's see what that is. What did I do wrong? 98113. Am I saying it wrong? 44313. It likes that one. All right, so we could see that on a map if we wanted. I'm not sure where it is.
Akron.
There we go. All right, there it is. And I guess I skipped over. Here's the data for that area. 21.5% old and newcomers, 17% young and restless, 8.2% middle constants, and here's the annual spending habits, et cetera. Now, if you actually engage the company, you're going to get a lot more information about the segments that live in all of these different areas. Could that be valuable for you as a marketer? Sure, sure. This is us hearing an old story, but you'll get the point of thinking about economics for an industry. This is the auto industry and economic.
Today was report card day for the auto industry, and it was a good one. Sales surged in December, capping a fifth straight year of growth for car makers. Analysts expect final sales for the year to exceed 17 million, a figure that hasn't been reached in more than a decade. Cheap gas helped boost sales of trucks and SUVs and luxury vehicles. Today, the price of oil briefly tumbled below $50 a barrel.
Before the bottom fell out of the economy, the car companies, especially ones from Detroit, were addicted to the sales of big trucks and SUVs. When gas prices skyrocketed, the companies nearly lost it all. Well, now we have crazy low gas prices and consumers are gobbling up SUVs. Jeep, for example, was one of the biggest winners as consumers picked crossover SUVs. Its sales were up more than 40% for the year. At the same time, hybrid sales and alternative vehicle sales took a hit in 2014. Even though some of the hunger for bigger cars has picked up, maybe Detroit executives have learned a lesson from their near-death experience, and they haven't forgotten yet.
What you cleared out of the system in the last 4 or 5 years was 40 or 50 years of accumulated, perhaps bad behavior.
Painter says even though bigger vehicles are more profitable, today's cars, no matter the size, are far more fuel efficient. Stephanie Brindley with IHS Automotive says this 17 million is much healthier than the last time the industry hit 17 million cars a year. She says the industry has learned a very basic economic lesson.
The automakers in general have shifted to adjusting production for demand overall. So what will happen now is that if an auto manufacturer is seeing a vehicle not performing to expectations, they can adjust the number of vehicles that they produce.
So if gas skyrockets, then she says car makers can, in theory, shift from making big SUVs to making small cars. Meanwhile, Michelle Krebs with AutoTrader.com says consumers only save a few hundred dollars because gas is cheaper. That's not enough to send them into the dealership.
People keep focusing a lot on just gas prices, but that's not the full picture. There's a big economic picture at play here as well.
Krebs says the health of the auto industry comes not as much from cheap gas as from an improving unemployment rate, improving consumer confidence, low interest rates, and
credit was widely available, and we saw a big increase in leasing. So that made vehicles available to more people on a wider spectrum of creditworthiness.
Krebs says the business model for car makers has changed in the last decade. Car makers can turn a profit selling far fewer cars. Krebs says she expects consumers and car companies to enjoy the cheap gas while it lasts. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
Now, obviously, the crest factors have changed since then, but a couple important things we get out of this. One is, for a very long time, major car manufacturers had a product focus. What they would, they create cars and create cars and create cars, and they weren't selling. Too bad, we're creating more of that car because it's what we had scheduled. And then they'd have to they'd sit in the lots, they'd have to discount the cars. Finally, they learned marketing 101. You have to adjust your production for the demand. Duh. But okay, they really didn't get that. The second point here is while the factors change, cheap gas is no longer a big worry right now, you have to pay attention to them and ask what's it going to mean into your future. And right now, of course, the big thing, I got to find a new, it's not easy to find these things, talking about this stuff, the new electronic vehicle impact on the business. As those social norms change, legal issues change, and we have to focus more on that stuff. This is Felber talking about his B2B services. He's doing marketing service for a company, and he's thinking about the impact of economic forces there.
The economic slowdowns, we've been through several of them. This particular one, as it hits raw materials and fuel costs and petroleum-based products, is hitting everywhere. And it's hitting a little faster. The larger clients that we work with are getting ahead of the curve. Some are feeling the pinch right away. Others are anticipating feeling the pinch. So what can we learn as a small business from this? A, it's affecting our clients. It affects us. It may affect us a little more dramatically down the road. But what we're trying to do is find ways to help them. And this may mean that the current services we're providing them now might need to be put on hold, and we may need to address other things that we can help them in the immediate need. For example, if they're really pushing for sales and we're working on public relations, and public relations is generating leads, but sales doesn't have literature to fulfill, maybe we need to focus our attitudes. And that's happened in some clients where we've really need to hone down what do they need right now in this particular setting. So adjusting to our clients' needs is important. And what we're learning is that our job is going to be to have some more foresight on the next slowdown or the next major turn, whatever that event may be, and try to anticipate what our clients are going to go through. That's what will add value down the road for our clients.
Hello. Three more minutes. I'm not going to keep you after five. Don't panic. So what in our environment do you think we have to be thinking about as a possibility upcoming if we're in business, whether it's B2B or B2C? What are we concerned about upcoming in the economic environment?
Inflation rising,
which is going to generate, arguably, as we control that inflation through higher interest rates, what's that going to potentially do to the economy? Put us potentially into a recession. You got to be planning for that. You got to be thinking about it. You got to be aware of it. Now you can go home. Thank you.